If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
This week's episode of Game Dev Unchained is sponsored by us. That's right. This one is for all the students and new hires in the game development industry. We've compiled all of our career tips and secrets into a must-have guide called Game Dev Unchained Game Industry Survival Guide. This 10-chapter book breaks down the most important steps that you need to really get your career going. So if you love our podcast, you definitely want to check out our book. It's available today on Amazon. All right. Thanks, guys.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls all over the globe and the world, even though that's the same thing, this is one half of the amazing Game Dev Unchained podcast team. You know the voice, it's Larry Charles, and I bring with us two special guests. One goes by the name of Mr. Brandon Pham.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Piggybacking off Larry this week, this is Brandon Pham. I have brought the other special guest, Dion Carrico.
Welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, man. Good to see you. It's been a while.
It has been way too long.
Yes. For those who don't know.
Like how long has it been?
Since I've seen you personally, I think in person, I'd say about 6 years.
Yeah, that's way too long.
Dion and I worked together once before on a company we started called Go Play Games, making iPhone games. Dion, where do you work now? Why don't you tell the users about yourself and what you do?
Yeah, I work at a board game company now called Victory Point Games, and I've been there for about 6 years, starting literally in my boss's attic to the office that we're in today. So
yes.
One hell of a journey.
Yes, man. And we're excited to talk about board games and analog games today.
Yeah, like one of the biggest interests, and I think it's one of those things that kind of dwindle a bit after Monopoly and all those like famous board games, but suddenly there's been like a resurgence, especially with Kickstarter and all these self-funding programs. You're seeing Cards Against Humanity. You're seeing like these huge RPG type of board games coming out of Kickstarter campaigns with millions and millions of dollars backed up. Like there's a huge need for it now, especially for social gathering. A lot of people are stuck behind their computer playing with their friends, but online. So that person-to-person type of communication is very necessary, and I think people really want it now, especially with how good the board games are becoming.
So. To kind of back up the statements that you're making, I just a couple days ago saw an article on Gamma Sutra where they kind of did like a Kickstarter year in review for, you know, major games, like how are the different types of categories of games. And one of the interesting things is that it seems like tabletop games on Kickstarter is literally at an all-time high. I wish I remembered the numbers now. Actually, no, I do. Kickstarter in 2016 brought in roughly about $100 million in total Kickstarter campaigns, which is like for board games, that's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. That's really good. So it's interesting kind of seeing board games take off. And if you asked me 6 years ago, if I was 6 or 7 years ago, if I was going to work at a board game company, I'd say no.
Yeah.
You know? But here we are, and it seems to be taking off. So, yeah.
Do you mind giving us a little bit of background of, you know, where you worked at, a little bit more of Victory Point Games and all that? Just give an audience a little
intro. Sure. So when I started at a Victory Point Games, whereas I think GoPlay was starting to finally run its course. And at the time, Alan, my boss now, offered Larry a job, and Larry said, no, thank you. And he passed it along to me. And then I took it and I just ran with it ever since then. When I first started at Victory Point, it was in my boss's attic, and we literally made everything by hand. Mm-hmm. I would take the counters that you're moving around. You'd literally be pressing them every single day. So when I first started, that was it. It was manufacturing. We with the capabilities that we had on hand, all we could do was just build all day long. And from there, it was me, and then it was another person. Then We just started slowly adding more and more people. As time has gone on, we've moved to out of house, and the out of house thing for us is a relatively new thing. About 2 years ago, we finally went to our first out of house print, which is going to talking to China and ordering like a 1500, 2000, 5000 unit print run. Whereas before, the one thing that we were trying to do was build everything in house in our own office, with our own printer, our own manufacturing, and just try to be completely independent. But with the demand of board games and how much money we needed to bring in, we decided, well, maybe it's finally time we join everyone else and go out of house and make that higher quality product. And it seems to be working so far.
Do you prefer printing in-house or do you prefer printing out of house as a game company?
As a game company? Well, with the economy of scale from a purely producer standpoint, I love going out of house because the we can get back per unit. Your company can be much more sustainable, where if we did it in-house, there's no economy of scale. And it was much more expensive for something that's not quite the same quality physically. You know, and for a board gamer, that physical component is important. It's got to feel good moving the components around.
And you also said that you didn't anticipate going to work for a board game company 6 years ago. Now doing it, how do you feel? Do you still have the same reservations? Are you twice as excited? Or I guess, where are you?
I guess I kind of still see board games as a more niche market than the current video game industry. Mm-hmm. That being said, I can totally see myself working in the board game industry for a while now.
Oh, nice.
Like, we'll do it after being in it for 6 years. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember when Alan first announced Victory Point Games. And even so, Alan's a little background was all our teachers at some point at AI. One of the best teachers I ever had. Very motivational.
Amen. Amen.
Very knowledgeable. He used to be a history teacher, so that helped a lot. So his lessons are very educational. And I remember he was really big on analog games. And at first, I didn't even know analog games were called analog games. I was like, oh, okay. So he showed us how to prototype with them before working on the computer. You know, the ideas of prototyping. It was very, very good. Lessons that I don't think students nowadays really get a handle on. Not a lot of teachers use things that you can pick up as a source to prototype your game. They usually just go straight to Unreal and stuff. But like the value is so good, right? You just take a bunch of paper clips and a cup here and there, whatever you can grab, and instantly you should be able to create something fun with your simple idea. And so. Right. When I saw Victory Point Games, I was like, yeah, man, there's something here. And this is before it got trendy, right? Before the Kickstarters and everything.
Right.
When did you guys start to – obviously, you guys knew what was there. Obviously, it was a company full of passion of analog games. And obviously, there's a niche, right? But mm-hmm. What I'm seeing is like towards mainstream, now it's becoming better and better. So when did you guys, during the beginning, felt – that tide turning a bit of how the industry is starting to appreciate analog games more, at least the mainstream guys?
Like, we, okay. So when did we start noticing like, oh my gosh, people are actually buying things?
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember one point in time in our industry, there's this board game that we have, and it's kind of been a staple at our company. It's called The Darkest Night. Mm-hmm. We ran a Kickstarter for the second edition of that back in May of last year, and it did pretty well. I think we got about 200 grand plus on that one. But I remember this is for the first edition of Darkest Night, and just to back up what you said about Alan, he is absolutely passionately driven for board games. Like, that is his life. He is all about this. So anyone that's played any of our games know that he literally puts his heart and soul in these projects. And one of those projects big time was Darkest Night, because I remember he got this game and we had just had a meeting about it, talking about when we're going to release it. And he stopped the office and he kind of had one of those trademark Alan Emmerich, like, heartfelt moments, right? Where he sat there and he kind of looked around and said, you know, I have a feeling that this might be one of those games that when they think of us, they'll think of us because of this game. And I think that's when we knew that we kind of maybe latched on a little bit to the board game market, and then B, that there was actually a pretty decent sized market out there for this. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a lot of, like, one of the biggest things with indie titles, right, analog or digital, is just being there before the trend starts. Like, I feel like a lot of developers that go indie often kind of just see what's happening, like, especially VR, right? VR being an example. Everybody's loving VR. Even we on this podcast would say, you know, if you go indie, VR is the market to go indie. So it doesn't really start with an idea. It's more starting on, oh, this is the trend. So if you want to latch on and capitalize on this trend, you kind of go in that direction. And that can be dangerous if you don't have a good idea, right?
Right.
So it's so valuable that you guys kind of went there first, kind of just with the passion. Like, we like doing this. We know some people that like it. It's not mainstream, which is fine. We have a market. And as long as we satisfy that market, you know, something may happen versus the others. Like, especially now, analog games are kind of blowing up. Cards Against Humanity. What is that one with the cartoonists who make all exploding cats or something? That one's crazy.
Exploding kittens. Yeah.
Yeah.
There is a big one. I can't remember the name, from Cyanide and Happiness. That one did phenomenal also.
Yeah.
I think the Exploding Kittens game has the record for, I think they got like 10 million or something like that.
They got an insane amount of numbers.
For cards. I mean, don't be fooled though. Like, a lot of that money, I mean, 10 million bucks. Yeah. But a lot of that money went into the actual physical production.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To make those too. Things. But they're very happy, I bet.
Yeah. They got to be dancing. Like, when they saw the 10 million, they had to have thrown a party.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it was obvious. Yeah. I mean, those type of things are hard. So it's like someone right now who never had interest in analog games or board games, or somewhat they play Monopoly once in a while, but it's not like a genuine interest. And they see this like huge market coming out of Kickstarter, especially the 2016 yearly revenues. They're like, oh, we got to make a board game now. And I feel like there's a lot of that happening, both digitally and analog. They just see what's the trend and they jump on it without a clear goal to accomplish something. Yeah.
Yeah. What we'll see every once in a while too is there'll be like a video game will take off and they'll want to support it, and they'll try to bring more attention to their brand by making a board game off of it. Mm. I think an example of that, I don't know if that was their goal, but an example of that is the Dark Souls board game. Mm. The Kickstarter that came out. I don't know if you guys were aware of that one or not, but that's another one that did phenomenally. And it was because of the IP that was behind it. There's a lot of passionate Dark Souls people. And I guess it's kind of introducing board games to a whole group of people that wouldn't even think about it.
So was that published by the same guys then, the actual people who were behind it, or was fan made or something?
Oh shoot, I don't know. I think they I can't remember the name of the company, but I know they licensed it out to a board
game. Okay, they just licensed IP. So do you see that happening a lot more
absolutely. Okay. Yeah, you see a lot of that. One of the big companies that's doing that is a company called Fantasy Flight, and they work a lot with a lot of different IPs, like Star Wars. They do a ton of Star Wars IPs. There's a card game came out recently called Star Wars Destiny, and it is selling hotcakes. You can't find it anywhere.
Mm. Sounds like it's doing better than their iPhone game.
What's their iPhone game? Which one's the Fantasy Flight's?
Oh no,
they have a new Star Wars game that came out. Kind of, yeah.
Oh,
it's like I played that ish, right?
It was fun. I played it, but then I stopped because I was kind of obsessing over it a little bit because I had to get the next free thing, you know? Yeah. So is that one not doing that well, or?
Oh, no, I just couldn't resist the joke opportunity.
Yeah, I think it's doing all right. It's like probably top 10 or something.
Yeah. Yeah, because I remember I played that. It's fun. But to go to Fantasy Flight games, they work, IPs. For them, like, they're getting a lot of really solid IPs with really solid game design. They have Star Wars. They've done Lord of the Rings games. Game of Thrones. They had the Warhammer 40K license up until recently, until I think Games Workshop decided to do their own thing again. Mm. Yeah.
Is that a lucrative side of the business? Think that that's something that Victory Point could aspire to do, or is that not so much?
I wouldn't mind finding the right IP and then associating an excellent game with it. I think that would be fantastic. Mm-hmm. I think we would have to convince Alan that that's the way to go.
Gotcha.
Because Alan is very proud of the fact that we are as independent as we possibly can be.
Mm-hmm. Amen to that.
Yeah, because we release a game that is fun. We release a game because it's fun, not because it has this huge license attached to it. You know, he always says a game should stand on its own merits, and an IP shouldn't change that.
There's a lot of honor in that too.
There is a lot of honor in that. That being said, I still would love to throw an awesome IP on top of it.
Definitely doesn't hurt. Just to see, maybe there's a good game idea, and then you guys have an IP that might be perfect for it. I mean, sometimes that's the pitch. It's like, oh, you know what would be great? Let's go ask them.
Go ask these guys to see. Yeah, because this feels like it would be this title.
So, Dion, I represent a lot of game designers, and if I'm thinking about releasing a board game, would it be worth coming to you guys to say, hey, I have a pitch for this game. Would you guys evaluate it for publishing? Is that something that you guys do? Or
Are you sending us an idea or an actual prototype?
I would show up with a prototype, not with just a document. Like, we would play it and, you know, we could drink some beers and have some fun. But a lot of people who are game developers, you know, talk about making board games, and I've seen a lot, but they don't take it past just making something, you know, like a prototype. They don't know about the marketing or the business end. So is that something that you guys could fulfill?
Dude, if you have if you're Joe developer or Joe designer and you, well, not literally walk into our office, but if you come to us and say, hey, I have this prototype and I want to show it to you, we have an open door policy. You can absolutely bring it to us. And we will absolutely take a look at it. Do you remember Nate Hansen, Go Play?
Yes, I do.
He works with us also. And he's he's another guy that bleeds cardboard.
All right. Shout out to Nate.
Yeah, shout out to Nate. And so what happens is someone brings in their prototype and we will take your prototype and we will look at it. And it either goes to Alan or it goes to Nate, and they mull over your prototype and then they give feedback back to it. So it's either we like it and we want to work with it more, or it needs some work and here's why.
Mm.
Yeah. Can come talk to us.
Has anyone showed up with a day one home run?
Yes. I can't remember any of the games off the top of my head, but we've had some games that have come in and said, well, let's just push this through. Let's put some art on it. Let's make it look real nice and shiny. And then, yeah, release it.
The game developers out there, designers or not, you know, if you have a wonderful prototype of a game, Victory Point will take it. And this isn't a shameless plug. They're actually doing it. This isn't a commercial. They're legit.
Talk to us. I know, again, to go on, one of the things Alan's proud about, it's that he has a very open door policy. The people who, even if you haven't done anything, if you don't have a track history or anything, he will look at your game and he wants to give people that opportunity to get into the door. Like, it ties very much into him being a teacher. He wants to give you your shot.
Okay. And my last question on behalf of Game Develop, is there such thing as too many no's for Victory Point Games? If I've showed up 5 times with different games, can I show up with a 6th one?
I see. So okay. So if you've submitted 3 or 4 not solid ideas.
Sure. Yes.
I think we don't have it a standard after we say no to you so many times, but there's kind of this unspoken thing once we've gotten enough bad submissions that we start saying thanks, but no thanks.
Gotcha.
You know? Yeah. Granted, we'll tell you what we don't like about it and what we suggest on how to change it, but yeah, after a while, yeah, we do have to work on things we know we're going to move forward.
Understood. And I think it's awesome that you're willing to accept submissions. So that's all I really wanted to ask on behalf of game developers out there.
Yeah, send us stuff. We'll work with you. No problem.
So what's the usual dev cycle from prototype to a finished product on a particular game? How much does it range?
Oh, you see, that all depends on the scope of the game, because it could be a simple card game where after maybe like a month or two, we have something. But more often than not, we're looking at about, once it's in-house, once it's done, I'll say anywhere from on the development side. I mean, we're still looking at about maybe a half a year max, maybe less, depending on how much work needs to be done. And then where I come in, that's when we ship it off to the printer, and that can be another, at least another 90 days. If everything goes smooth, maybe we'll get it in 90 days. So we're talking about from solid game that needs very little tweaking to end, it's still like about 9 months to a year before we'll see it on the shelves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is it ever like a target that you guys try to obtain as far as analog goes, or is it just getting to the market? How do you get in front of customers usually when you have something? Is it through online broadcasting and it's ordering online, or is it on the shelf? Like, how exactly is that track when you have a finished product?
Well, for us, I think that's something that has slowly changed as we've grown as a company. Mm-hmm. Because back when I started, the answer was get as many games. Like, we get a lot of submissions. Let's get those games out there as fast as possible. We used to have a release schedule where Alan's goal was every 2 weeks we release a new board game.
Mm.
And that was hectic and that was crazy. And people were starting to tear their hair out of their heads a little bit. So the answer to that one was announce it on the website, announce it on Facebook, get it out there, send it to reviewers. But with us kind of growing as a company, it's more find the game that is legitimately fun, find out how to get it to reviewers, have them review it, build up interest. And once we have people talking about it, see if we can either push it and sell it on our storefront, sell it at other retailer stores, distribution. And if we think it's big enough, we'll shove it out there for a Kickstarter.
Mm-hmm. So the reviews are usually the one that gets the, because I'm guessing there's a lot that goes on the market. And so if I'm a fan of analog games, what's the site that I usually go for?
You want to go to boardgamegeek.com.
That's the biggest one.
That's the big one. BGG. Like it's like the big one. It's like, I'm not joking. It's like the hub that you go to. Yeah. Whereas like, I know with video games, like I know there's several different big sites you go to, but for board games, it's boardgamegeek.com. Yes.
So is this where the retailers actually check out too? If you ever wanted to get it at, so if I were ever to want to get my thing on Target, on Walmart, like where, like how does that conversation get into play? Is it something you just literally call them up and say, hey,
that's that's something that like, we're not quite there yet. We kind of know the guidelines that we need to get into those stores.
Yeah.
But a lot of times that's dealing with, I'm backing on the distribution. Cause right. A lot of times Target or Walmart, more than anything else, what they look at is they look at the shelf price and the shelf space, how much space is this actually going to take up? How much revenue can they get back from that unit? And then once that meets that standard goal, then they say, okay, will this actually sell at our store?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So yeah, I hope that answers your question.
No, that totally answers your question. Well, the thing is, I always go into retail, right? And I always look at the analog section and you get your normal stuff. And
right.
I'm starting to see this section where you over the past year, I saw on Kickstarter campaigns, you know, part of the $100 million revenues that they gathered on Kickstarter last year. And that section is starting to grow. And I see more and more people just hanging around in that particular section. So I'm anticipating that Target notices that they're selling well and that they know that, you know, maybe their analog games are doing better than the digital, because digital games, as we all know, people are buying it digitally. Like they see that it's shrinking over there on that side, but the analog games, I've just been noticing people just hanging out. They're more, it's usually sold out. A lot of the card games are sold out. So I don't know if they're actively trying to look for Kickstarter campaigns or wherever, Board Game Geek or something, because I think they know that the trend is happening.
Yeah, I don't quite know for sure, but I bet they have someone that knows that market and they can kind of keep an ear out for that. And yeah, I know a lot of it is on the back end with distributors that push it directly to places like Walmart and Target and Barnes & Noble, which I love going to Barnes & Noble and walking around their board game stuff, because they have a lot of things that I wouldn't even think would be there, but they got to be selling well or else they wouldn't be there in the first place.
Yeah, it's not like they're selling books or anything.
I hate seeing them kind of closed down
the way
they are.
Yeah. Do you know they closed down the one off of
it's Metro Point.
On.
Yeah.
That makes me sad. I think we go played in that one a couple of times.
Yeah.
Did we?
I'm sure you guys did. I mean, it's like one of those best places to hang out. That's the thing, man. They need to, like, I was talking, I won't spend too much time on it. GameStop has the same issue, right? They're not selling games.
Right.
What they have are these great spaces where people can hang out. So Barnes & Noble is the same. Like, they just need to make it more like a co-working space.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up. That's exactly what a lot of mom and pop board game shops said. The Friendly Local Retailer, FLGS, Friendly Local Game Store. Mm-hmm. They make it very much like a come here and play with your friends at this board game shop. Mm-hmm. And so they're trying to build that culture around those individual stores. And yeah, I hope it works out, because those little mom and pop shops are important to the board game industry.
Yeah, they have. Just shove all the books to the corners. Right? Just set up tables in the middle. Mm-hmm. Because that's what people like. You know, people go around the malls and stuff, and then they see a crowd gathering every weekend doing something at Barnes & Noble. It's cool. Yeah, we'll hang out. I'm telling you, man, I'm going to solve all these guys' problems if you guys are listening. It's so stupid, man. They have such great spaces, but they keep trying to push books in the nook. It's like, shut the F up. What are you talking about? You just admitting defeat. Yeah.
I think that's what they were trying to do by having like a Starbucks in there.
They're so old. Yeah, the Starbucks helped. But right. The Starbucks is what's like the only thing that's working there, right?
People. That's what I said. I bet more people are upset that there's no Starbucks there anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, they don't have Starbucks anymore? They took all the Starbucks?
The whole thing closed.
And
the Starbucks was inside.
Oh, for that particular Barnes & Noble.
Yeah, for that one.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. These guys are so blind. They literally don't go into the stores and see what people hang out there for and ask people. I think if they just ask questions, people will like, yeah, I like hanging out here to do some work sometimes. Oh, okay.
You know what's really interesting is that a lot of Barnes & Noble's losing a lot of sales, and it's books and board games. To Amazon, direct sales to Amazon, right? But Amazon is actually starting to open up brick and mortar shops now. Like they're going full reverse. I think they're opening up a bookstore in New York, like downtown Manhattan.
A bookstore? What are they doing differently?
I couldn't tell you. I don't know. I think it's just that they have the Amazon logo, so people know that they can go buy the books at Amazon.
They better do something good. Because right. I know they have the kiosks for the food stuff now.
That seems interesting.
Yeah, it's just like an airport security a gate thing.
Right.
But they just place it in a grocery store, and so you just go in and go out, and I guess it IDs you without you having to wait in line.
I'd be worried about spending $400 on one kiwi because I keep on putting it back and forth.
Yeah. So I don't know how they're figuring it. I'm sure with their books, they're going to do something special because, everything that I'm seeing with these stores, with the trend, it's all about hanging out with people physically. Like, why would you want to compete with Amazon selling books by selling books? It's not going to work. What Amazon can't do is physically having people next to each other and talking about the book, or like, do they even have that? Sorry, we're going off track here, but do they? No, like,
it actually does kind of relate to something a little bit. I know there was one that opened up kind of recently, but board game cafes are increasingly becoming a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know if they have it a lot around here, but I know there's a few that are popping up throughout the states.
LA has some.
Yeah, it has them. Yeah, just a board game cafe where you go there, you order a coffee, rent a game, you plan to hang out with your friends.
That's an idea right there, man. You guys need to hit up Starbucks. Yeah.
Actually, that's not a bad idea. Carry our games across.
Yeah, like
you may have actually struck something that I might bring up at work tomorrow.
Yeah, well, I'm all full of ideas, man. Just open up and open up your ears. I'm about to give you some gems here. Just make some furniture out of your board games, right? Like a table,
right?
Add a tabletop. Sell that furniture,
okay,
to Starbucks. Because coffee shops, man, are like the best places for board games. I'm surprised they don't. I mean, if you went to boba places and stuff, if you guys don't know what boba places are, just Google it. But literally, they have analog games and stuff, you know, tucked in a cupboard. And they encourage people to hang out and drink their drinks. But I'm very surprised Starbucks hasn't picked up on this. Board games lying around where customers can play.
There's too many people writing screenplays that probably complain about the noise.
Stupid. Right.
But like, yeah, no, there's got to be games that you can sell to them that works with their brand and their kind of, I guess, aura they want to give off.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, the goal with these physical places is just getting you to stay there as much as possible. I mean, Starbucks don't want to just sell you coffees and see you leave, man. They encourage people to stay there. And board game complements that very well. I mean, I just want to see that blow up more.
Yeah, I'm literally going to bring this up to my marketing guy tomorrow.
You're welcome. You are welcome. So we have another question here. Victory Point Games have... Are you guys ever thinking of going digital, or is it going to be analog games? Yeah, turning any of your board games into a real game, talking to people, getting that going?
We tried kind of making our own mobile games in the past, and it just didn't work out. Like, that was kind of my focus for a while. We were kind of, for us, we were stretching ourselves too thin. We weren't able to do both of them at once. And yeah, our poor programmer, Logan, just stressed out, because it was like towards the end, like especially at the end, it was all on his shoulders. But if we are to do anything digital at this point out, we'd find someone to contract out with to make like a mobile app, or maybe something for like, I don't know, PlayStation Plus.
Have you guys thought of doing AR stuff? Like, board games are kind of perfect for that, isn't it? Augmented reality stuff?
No, we haven't thought about that. I mean, we've
seen, gems here for your marketing guy, man. I'm telling you.
Here, Grant, boom. Here's another one.
Well, you see it sometimes, right? I think Microsoft HoloLens or whatever, they were demoing a sort of half-ass board game, but like, right. I would love to see like a real intense type of thing going on in. It's a board game that you buy, but then you have all these cards that actually pop up AR stuff.
I guess for us, that the real debate would be, how much would it cost to make that work? You know, what type of investment is needed to make that a reality?
Mm-hmm. That's like a whole different team.
That's a whole different team. And board games relative to video games are dirt cheap to make.
Yeah.
You know, so to go to a board game company and say, do AR, we're like, holy crap, how are we going to have the funds for this?
Yeah. It's not ready yet. Those AR sets are like $4,000 to buy one, like one of those Microsoft HoloLens.
Yeah, something crazy.
But the phones are able to do that. I'm just
wondering. Yeah, the phones are pretty close.
I was actually thinking Samsung VR. How would you do that?
No. Well, like even your regular phone, you can do AR stuff.
Yeah,
you just need a chip on the cards to activate it or something.
Yeah, I think we would have to rely on a dev house to come to us and say, hey, we like this game.
Yeah,
we
want to change it. Yeah, there's a lot of
reasons. Yeah, just a lot of time and resources that as a board game company, would probably be better spent on the expansion for that game or the next upcoming game that we know is going to bring in money.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like,
what's the average customer? I mean, you know, with digital games, usually around Christmas, you buy one or two games. I think the number when Emmerich was teaching us was like 3 to 4 games a year, maybe 2 games a year that a person would buy. With analog games, does that number kind of differ?
You know, I don't know. I don't have access to that. Yeah, so sorry, I don't have an answer for you for that one. Because it could be like there's a lot of casual people that like this is the game that they get for the year. But what we kind of see a lot, like at least with us, because I know we're kind of have a lot of hardcore board gamers that play, but there's people that just love to build their collection to the point where they actually have a few board games that they haven't opened yet. Mm. Yeah. Just because they haven't had the chance to sit down and play it yet.
Can you tell if you get a lot of repeat sales from those guys? Just either the same game or different games, just... they're just a fan of what you guys produce?
Oh, yeah. We definitely have some fans that are dedicated to Victory Point games and love buying Victory Point games. There you go. So, yeah, we definitely have those guys. Yeah, but as far as, like, how much everyone buys, I don't quite have access to that. I don't know.
Yeah. It's interesting, man. Like, I see analog games kind of solving all the digital sales problem. It's kind of like the opposite problem. Like the digital sales, like I said, GameStop's closing, Best Buy is dying. Like no one's
Best Buy dying too?
I feel like they're on their last legs. I'm surprised they're still up, to be honest. For years now you've been hearing Best Buy closing down. I mean, no one buys TVs from them anymore. You just go to Costco now. Or even just stay on Amazon.
Well, I mean, people still want to go and pick up like their Xbox One or their PS4 discs, right? The shops. Yeah. But even then, you could order that through Amazon also.
Amazon's taking everybody's business.
Oh, how dare they?
you can't beat their motto, man. They said for years they just break even just long enough so that the other industries close down. And so right when they close down, like Barnes & Noble, they open a bookstore. That's their strategy.
That's their model. That's what they do. Break even until you win.
Yeah. And then it was like, you know what? For years they argue, Barnes & Noble, no one wants to buy books in your bookstore. And then they're like, all right, now they're gone. Let's open a bookstore. You know, that's a great idea. I'm interested to see how they're doing it differently.
What's that?
I want to see how they're doing it differently because – obviously, they have a different way of doing it.
Air Prime,
yeah. Did you guys hear about that plan? How they having like a drone, like a blimp? That was like one of their ideas. They have a blimp full of all this stuff. And so when you order anything, it just airdrops with the drone. Like that's an actual idea they had. I don't know if it's in progress or whatever, but that's something I read. So they have a blimp lying around. Yeah.
The Kaiser's slip is just floating to drop off its goods. Okay.
Oh, yeah. They have enough money. That's
crazy. Oh, dude, they do. They really do. They've done well for themselves. Yeah. I guess is an understatement.
So anyways, going back to it, where do you see the industry going? I mean, we talk about how it's trending mainstream now. People are getting it. So where do you see the next 5 years analog exploding? In what sector? How?
Next in the next few years? Man, you know, some of the articles I've read about why board games have kind of taken off the way they have is because of the gamers, I guess, like myself, of my age. They're grown up. They're having family. They're having kids. And it's the board game that's kind of bringing everyone together. And that's what everyone's playing. I think as long as we have that element, that board games aren't going anywhere and might actually increase in sales as time goes on. Mm-hmm. The one thing I've noticed specifically with us is that we noticed that we can't really sell kids games. Kids games don't do well through us, but games geared towards people my age, people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, those are taking off. So I think we'll be seeing grown-up games, I guess, for lack of a better word. And I think they're going to be around for a while.
what kind of kid games now that are mainstream? Like, I only know like the old ones, but what's a recent one that's been really good with kids?
Oh man, I have that answer, just not right now.
So it is like there are new games that are coming up for kids that parents are buying for them, right?
Well, yeah, I'm sure there's plenty of educational games that are out there, but mainly what a lot of parents seem to be looking for is something they can play that they feel is interesting, that they can play along with, they can introduce their child, so they can both sit there and kind of bond over that.
Mm-hmm. It's like the board game version of Minecraft.
Yeah.
Something like that.
So it's like usually an IP driven type of board game to sell to kids.
Yeah. Like something like Adventure Time related.
Mm. Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, something along those lines.
Yeah.
Which, yes, tying video games to IPs. Have you guys heard about the League of Legends board game?
No, I haven't heard of it.
It came out. It's a board game called Mechs versus Minions, and when it came out, it was a huge splash, at least from our perspective in the game industry. Because, yeah, they did. I don't quite know the gameplay elements of it, but essentially they took like monster waves coming at you, and Riot just came in and they kind of rocked everyone's world for a little while with Mechs versus Minions coming out. Like if you wanted an introduction to board games,
that's the one.
And you're an avid video game player, see if you can get your hands on this one, which you can only buy it directly through them, by the way. yeah, last I checked.
So was it like a licensed out type of deal, or did Riot
design? They just made it.
And they pushed it.
Yeah, they just made it themselves. Yeah, all themselves. It's, yeah. Never, well, word of the wise, it's expensive.
Yeah, I'm sure. But what I like about how the analog game industry is opening up, like I'm always loving the idea that the game developer has having more choices. So even as an analog, you're in there with, especially 3D printing now, you know, if you're a character artist, you can 3D print your characters and as pieces or make some board game elements or designs.
As a 3D modeler, I think you can, I don't know the, I'm pretty sure you can make a pretty decent chunk of cash being a 3D modeler trying to work for the board game industry making minis. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, that's actually it. Instead of having to sculpt it now, you just model it, ship the model off to the printer, and bada bing, bada boom, you got a model. I say it like it's that easy, but we were making minis for Darkest Night. Mm-hmm. Our board game, and that was to put it kindly, it's been a learning process.
I love your honesty.
Yeah.
So how much of the 3D printing helped you guys the recent years with all that production stuff?
It was key. It was absolutely key for us to do it. Because we had the models and we sent it off to the printer, and we immediately, before even going into production and just losing maybe thousands and thousands of dollars on these models, we're able to figure out what the problems were and then tweak it and then resubmit it and tweak it and then resubmit and then tweak. Yeah. So it saved us. I would say it saved us quite a bit of time and frustration, at least financially.
Yeah. I bet. Mm-hmm. It's just one of those things that being able to produce yourself in some capacity, and then when it's ready and perfect, you can mass produce it and not worry about it anymore. Because what's frustrating is just the testing phase and not seeing it working. It takes weeks to get
Yeah, and that's been a fun conversation with the bosses too. Why is it taking so long? Well, you know, just because, like, you said, the iteration process that you have to go through. But just like anything else, the more you do it, the better you are at it, right? The less it you got to go through.
So, speaking of developing products yourself, how about testing? Do you guys enjoy just playing around with your own games and that whole process? Is it always frustrating? I know the financial and, you know, the failures and stuff can be frustrating, but I'm sure at some point playtesting your own game is pretty fun. Or does it work right now?
The playtesting aspect is probably the funnest part, I gotta say. I'm very much on the back end production side of things, so I don't get to touch that very often. But when I do, I swear I'm like a kid in the candy store. I actually get to sit down and play with the designers. You know, yeah, and most games go through a very vigorous playtesting process, especially by Ellen and especially by Nate. Mm. Yeah.
So if a game comes out from VPG, it's got the Ellen and Nate stamp of approval.
Every game that comes out especially has the Ellen stamp of approval, and hopefully it has the Nate stamp also.
That's worth saying something. I need to send you guys some games.
So you can all can write you back and see. He'll be like, it's good, but here's everything I saw.
Larry, did you pay attention in college?
Right.
Why am I getting F's? It was just a suggestion.
Oh, man.
But yeah, Alan was starting a Victory Point about the same time we were doing Go Play.
Yeah.
I remember that. I remember sitting in that Borders bookstore, rest in peace.
Yeah.
Meeting up with them. Yeah.
Well, you know, if it wasn't for Alan Emmerich, there would be no Go Play games.
Yeah.
He was the first investor.
he can be very stubborn with the games that he's working on, with the titles that he's working on. He can also be a very, very generous man.
Yes, sir.
And I've come to appreciate that over the years.
What's the best part about working underneath someone like him?
What is the best part? I guess when it's time to sit down and play a new game, he'll come just grab people and it's time. Just come sit down, play test this. We have a new submission. Let's take a look at it. I love how open he is. Mm-hmm. I love how open that the company is. Probably of all, let me put it this way. I used to work in the video game industry, right? On the video game side of things. And I was very used to being, you know, don't say anything, keep hush hush. We don't want any spoilers going out there. And then I came over to this board game company, and like the exact opposite was true. I kind of lost my mind a little bit. I was freaking out just because we didn't care about keeping secrets. Mm-hmm. About our IPs and stuff like that. I mean, a little bit we do, but not nearly to the extent of a digital video game. And at the beginning, that was a huge frustration because I didn't know what I was going to say that was going to get us in trouble. But as time has gone by, I've kind of appreciated that openness.
Is there a lot of competition between analog developers? Do you guys have a nemesis that you guys hate on every day?
Oddly enough, no. From what I see, no. I think that the board game industry, it's pretty damn large for the board game side of things, but more often than not, people are very, very willing to help each other and work out with each other, because if we do better, they do better. The bigger our industry gets, the more we all, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you know a good way of, I guess, dealing with freight, or if you know a good printer overseas that you can work with, people generally will talk about that and go back and forth and help each other out, which again is very nice to feel and see, you know. Mm-hmm. No puns you got to deal with.
Well, is piracy or copycatting a worry in analog as it is for digital games?
No, it's actually when I first started, this is one of the things I lost my mind over. When we would release a game, we would take the rule book and put it online for everyone to download. You know, so like, why are we like, my immediate thought is, why are we giving away our game? Why would you do that? But what it comes down to is that's something that the customers come to enjoy. It's like they read the rule book, they kind of preview the game to see if they would like it. And if they like it, they order it. Mm. Yeah. So piracy, not really. Someone stealing your idea, well, I guess you got to keep an eye out for that every once in a while. Mm. Or like taking a game and then just slapping a different skin on it.
That makes sense. I mean, it's not like Monopoly is scared.
Mm-hmm. No. They're doing fine.
They're doing fine.
Mm-hmm.
So like what is is there like a, I guess selling online in certain type of games, it depends, but is there like a certain threshold of too much when you're paying for an analog game, like when you're pricing it, especially?
The general rule of thumb is as long as you have the market to buy it, the more units you can get, the better. Mm-hmm. Because yeah, the larger your print run, the cheaper each unit is.
Okay.
So yeah, and one of the dealings that you have with the printer is you want to know what the price breaks are, like how many units do I have to purchase before you take a buck off or this becomes cheaper.
Right.
And so it really becomes a game. How many units can I order to make the unit as cheap as possible without breaking the bank?
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, you can absolutely buy way too many.
You guys these days.
Do I want to give that number?
Okay, never mind. If you can't.
Yeah. Yeah. No, sorry. That's my video game industry coming in and saying like, I don't know if you should say that, Dion. But yeah, it's a lot. It's not a lot as some of the other bigger guys that are out there. Like I know like Fantasy Flight or a lot of like Cool Mini or Not's another one that does very well on Kickstarter. They have to order like at least in the tens of thousands. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you guys have had, you know, your own success on Kickstarter. Like I've seen repeat success. It's like you guys are the Kickstarter oracles, in my opinion.
I remember having to fight pretty hard to convince Alan to use Kickstarter also.
Oh, really? There was a struggle because it was pretty new then, right? When you were first.
Yeah, it was pretty new. I think I was watching, was it Tim Schafer's company?
Double Fine.
I was watching Double Fine and how Double Fine was doing and how people were just so excited to pledge for him or to pledge to Obsidian for Pillars of Eternity. You know, my immediate thought was, oh my God, this could work for us too. But it took some convincing. And then after a while, we were able to start doing Kickstarters. And the interesting thing about Kickstarters is it's kind of become like the go-to spot for board gamers to come see like what is new and upcoming. Like if you're not like I keep on bringing up Fantasy Flight, but if you're not a Fantasy Flight or an Asmodee, which is another big board game company. Mm-hmm. One of the ways that you get the word out is by going through Kickstarter. And you try to get people built up and excited about the Kickstarter to come look at your product, because that's how you will be able to afford the print run to get your game out in the market.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, just seeing that number ahead of time helps a lot. It's like, how many people actually want to buy it? Okay. Let's print this much.
Yeah. It's really good at giving you a realistic view on how many units you can really sell in your game too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Kickstarter is more perfect for analog. Digital nowadays, it's kind of, unless like you guys start having our problem, which is like these, what, who makes the big ones? Parker Brothers? Is it Parker Brothers?
Milton Bradley.
Wait, let's say Milton Bradley just started to go to the Kickstarter. He's like, hey guys, we have this idea. It's like, shut the fuck up. I mean, that's what's happening with us right now with digital games.
Really?
Well, yeah, you hear these like ex Capcom executives come in asking for $200,000 for their AAA million-dollar project, right. And so that's and people have been screwed because of course they don't deliver, right? They don't have to. First of all, there's no penalty, and second, it's unrealistic. Yeah. It's a skewed view of what game development costs are. And so the people who are genuinely need the money or people who genuinely want to pay and help developers, it's either overpriced. It's like, well, we just paid Capcom $200,000 for a 2-year development. What do you guys need this much more for? It's, right. It's polluted now. So I that's part of the reasons why, at least for 2016, you were talking about analog games on the rise. Digital games have been dipping ever since it premiered.
I've noticed that too. A lot of big names asking for money for their company. I think it was one of the big ones. I can't remember the guy's name, but he did the Mighty Number 9.
Inafune.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was that a how did that one?
I think it came out all buggy though.
It came out eventually.
Eventually, yeah, it was really delayed. But people use it as a marketing platform. They don't really need the funds, so they underprice it with 20 AAA developers on the project, which is ridiculous. And then they delay it whenever they want to, and then it doesn't come out as expected. Really? So that's been happening a lot. So
yeah, so like I've seen that. But I take, like, from my perspective, because I've been in the cardboard world for so long, that I was under the impression that they needed this money to stay afloat as a company. And then once they got that money, they got the exact opposite.
It's No, so they've been, like, messing with the Kickstarter, which sucks, right? Like, Larry and I discuss this all the time. It's a place for two guys or three guys who want to make a game, and they're trying to find an audience. And can deliver.
Yeah.
It's being polluted by the AAA guys. So.
Yeah, which they which Fig, well, Fig has come around since then, right? Is that a bit of like an answer to that? To that?
Larry can probably comment it better than I do, but.
Sure. Fig is actually more honest. I feel like it's the halfway point, because ahead of time, the customers know that they can either pre-purchase the game, or they can up the ante financially and actually become an investor or a backer in a game and get revenue, or excuse me, get return on investment potentially, right? If some unknown game is promising investor returns and you don't see it happening, it hurts Fig. But actually, big games going to Fig, in my opinion, makes more sense, because from day one, the person giving you money kind of believes in the marketability of the product without having to be sold on it.
Right. Yeah, I kind of looked, and because the thing is, just working in a board game company, you kind of get hooked in a Kickstarter. Like that's for your big titles, at least for us, that's your bread and butter. And so you can't help but look at Fig, and I think they've priced it high enough to where the people that would throw money at it, like, you're throwing like $1,000 or $2,000 down.
Yeah.
And as an investor, one of the risks you go in is knowing that you might not get your money back.
Yeah.
And I think the price of entry, they've done it high enough to where you're not going to get like 16-year-old kids that threw $50 down demanding, you know, $500 back, or, you know, riches.
Yeah, they solve a few problems too. Like, there was just there was no policing on Kickstarter, so you don't know when a good game is coming out or whatever, because anyone can submit on any day. So Fig, at least 1 month per game, kind of helps give them some breathing room.
They've tried to put some more accountability on people. I know that if you get fulfilled, like, I'm pretty sure Kickstarter passed something that said if you just take this money and run, you can be held accountable. And I don't know if there's any direct, if I have any proof of that, but I feel like they followed through on that a couple times or a few times. I hope, knock on wood. Yeah, there's a huge trust issue. Less so with board games, because you can see the integrity of the people that you're working with. That really shines through. But I know that was a huge issue on the video game side of things.
Mm-hmm.
Also.
Well, Mr. Dion, if you look down at your handy stopwatch that we sent you last week, you'll notice that we've been podcasting for 1 hour.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, how about that? So at this time, Brandon and I are going to be quiet, and we're going to let you talk directly to the audience to promote, broadcast, or draw attention to something that you're involved in or that you're really excited about. Mr. Dion Carrico, or Car Chase Mode, the floor is now yours.
All right. Well, one of the things I'm really excited about, and I'm not just saying that because I worked on it, it's actually a lot of fun. It's this expandable card game that we released. If you've ever played Magic... It's not out yet, but if you ever played Magic the Gathering or any of the living card games out there, we just finished a Kickstarter for a game called Twilight of the Gods. And it did pretty well on Kickstarter. We got about $76,000, and we're going to be opening up pre-orders for that hopefully this week. And please go out and check it out. I think it's awesome. I'm getting at least one copy for it when it comes out. And you know what? You should really check it out too. It's a good game. It's a good game. Chris Cluey, if you know who he is the lead designer on that project too.
Well, there you have it, folks. Dion is here with us by way of Victory Point Games. And shout out to everyone at Victory Point Games holding it down for the Cardboard Warriors out there. We appreciate what you do. We love hearing the sound of dice clack on tables. And we're glad that you get to bring that to households all across the world. But since I'm the only one talking right now, my name is Larry Charles. I'm going to say good night.
This is Brandon Pham. Thanks for joining us. See you next week.
Oh, am I supposed to say something? Hi, I'm Dion. Thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun. Take it easy, guys.
If you enjoyed this podcast and you want to stay in touch or continue to follow our developments, then you need to go to facebook.com/GameDevUnchained and drop a like and stay in touch. You can also get the direct feed for this podcast on soundcloud.com/GameDevUnchained.